This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good day. Welcome to New Books in History, a podcast channel on New Books Network. My name is Dr. Charles Cotillo of the Royal Historical Society. I'm a host on the channel, and today I'm pleased and indeed honored to have with us Master Historian Professor Jeremy Black. Professor Black is Professor Emeritus of in the Department of History at X University. He is without a doubt one of the leading historians writing in the Anglophone world today, have written more than 175 books on various historical topics. And today we're discussing one of his newest books, Paris, A Short History, published by Thames and Hudson. Welcome, Professor Black.
Hello. Yes, and this Paris book, I hope a number of the listeners will read. Those of you who've already seen my History of France, also published by Thames and Hudson, will know the model. And it also is similar to my History of London. So it pulls together a method I've already developed. But it's a very good book, and I hope listeners get a chance to have a look at it.
Professor Black, what is the origins of Paris?
The origins of Paris is that it was the capital of the Parisii, a relatively small Gallic tribe, that's pre-Roman tribe. And that capital was where now is the Île de la Cité, the island east of the island on which Notre Dame is. And that island was settled from about 200 BC.
And when exactly do we have any idea of when exactly did Paris become a government center, pre or post Roman?
Well, it was, it appears to have been the capital of that tribe. So in that sense, it was what the Romans would call an oppida, rather like the future Colchester in England for the Catalani. And I mean, it wouldn't have had, shall we say, the urban facilities, structures or practice of a town in the Roman sense. But I think it would be seen, yes, as a tribal capital.
Why did the Viking siege of 885 fail?
Well, the conventional reason for it, and I think there's no reason to doubt it, was that fortified bridges were used to block the Viking passage up the river. I think it's also important that there was good leadership. Odo, Count of Paris, proved a very good leader. And indeed, also the very fact that the city had a base on an island, the Île de la Cité, I mean, there was vulnerability of the suburbs on the other banks of the Seine. The monastery of Saint-Germain-des-Prés was largely destroyed. But the key thing was that there was an island centre, and by holding these fortified bridges, the Vikings were not able to encompass it. And this theme, I would emphasise, of good leadership, you can also see in England the contrast between Ethelred the Unready and his son Edmund Ironside, and the latter being so much more sophisticated and serious as a military leader, or indeed going back to the earlier period, Alfred of Wessex being a very effective military leader.
What explains Paris' growth in terms of population, etc., in the 13th and 14th centuries?
Well, I think it's fair to say that Paris benefited enormously from the growing sophistication of the French state and its success, particularly under Philip Augustus, who was ruler from 1180 to 1223. I mean, he drove King John of England out of the Norman and the Angevin inheritance. And what you've got with Paris then, in a way that wasn't the case in the 10th century, when France was a relatively modest kingdom, what you've now got is a successful kingdom, which means that resources, taxation in particular, are attracted to the capital, and that gives a tremendous value to the capital. And Philip Augustus, of course, enhanced Paris by constructing a major wall, generally dated to between 1190 and 1215. He began work on the Louvre as a fort. He granted the charter to the university in 1200 and did much to develop Les Halles, the market already established by Louis VI in 1135, but which was given permanent buildings in 1183. So I think it's fair to say that you're getting a large building. Indeed, the wall constructed by Philip enclosed 273 hectares. And it's generally argued, though there's no precise population figures, of course, because this is a pre-census age, it's generally argued that by 1200, Paris was overtaking London in population. And it also was benefiting from economic expansion. I mean, it was a key location for commerce up or down, depending upon which way you want to look at it, the River Seine, but also across the Seine. And all of that was important because northern France was becoming more significant in agrarian terms, in part also linked to its growing political stability.
What were medieval Paris's relations with the French monarchy?
I think one would fairly say there is a degree of variability. You can argue both ways. You can say, on the whole, the relations were relatively good, but you can also draw attention to disorder. For example, the Étienne Marcel episode in 1356 to 58, in which the provost of the merchants of Paris tried to pursue reform and public control of the government. There was opposition from nobles. There was general political chaos. And of course, when one talks about the monarchy in this period, one has to bear in mind that there was a degree of instability in the monarchy, in particularly the late 14th century, that Charles VI, who became king in 1380 and went on till 1422, so he pops up in Shakespeare's Henry V, of course, wasn't a terribly successful ruler. He himself faced an uprising in Paris in 1382, incidentally the year after the peasants' revolt in England, and again there was a not particularly impressive monarch in England, Richard II. And you know what happened in Paris is tax collectors were killed, there was widespread looting, the government collapsed in a way, and the order was restored by the army blockading the Seine, stopping food supplies from getting through, and agreeing to give an amnesty. Of course, once they took over, they then executed the rebel leaders. But the point I was making earlier about instability within the royal family, it was not only Charles, who was mentally ill from about 1393, but also the family members, the Dukes of Orléans and Burgundy, were rivals, and they fought it out, I think it's fair to say, in Paris and its suburbs in the early 15th century. And again, there was another revolt and linked to that in 1413 and again in 1418. But it's very difficult when one's talking about the royal authority itself being spliced between competitors. It's very difficult to see necessarily popular action as against royal authority. I think what one might better argue is that there is a vertical alignment of politics which encompasses sections of the royal family, aristocratic factionalism, and a degree of popular support. And one can argue that case, in fact, all the way through episodes of disorder, French Wars of Religion, for example, or indeed the early stages of the French Revolution, where the king's cousin, the Duke of Orléans, is a prominent figure in the agitation against the royal government.
How did Paris cope with the English occupation during the Hundred Years' War?
Yes, well, as you say, there was an English occupation, although in theory, Henry VI, who was crowned King of France, in fact, in 1430 in Paris, in theory, this was, again, another aspect of French civil war. And I think it's worth saying that the situation alters in 1435 when the Duke of Burgundy switches side. That leads to, Henry VI's sort of supporters being driven out in 1436. The key point I would say is that although there were conspiracies against Henry VI, there was a plot on behalf of Charles VII, and that was discovered in 1430, and that led to the hanging of six Parisians. But on the whole, people waited to see what was going to happen in terms of conflict between Henry VI and Charles VII. Charles VII himself had established his capital at Bourges and didn't enter Paris in triumph until 1437. I think it's worth saying that this was a moment in time when the capital potentially could have gone to a different city, and indeed Charles spent much of his subsequent reign, he goes on till 1461, living outside Paris. And indeed, his successor, Louis XI, who was born in Bourges, preferred not Paris, but Vincennes, where he felt more secure. So it took a while for the monarchs to get as it were, comfortable. I think it's fair to say, and to a degree they never were. I mean, the Renaissance monarchs spent a lot of time in the Loire Valley, in their palaces there, and there was this ambivalence about the loyalty of the capital city, which reflects in part not just political factors but also the social strife that could exist there.
Is that why you say that unlike New York or London, Paris, quote, had many changes of fortune, unquote?
Yes, I would say Paris did have many changes of fortune. And in fact, I would say that goes on until 1944. I mean, if you think about it, New York was last occupied when from the American perspective, the evil Brits turned up in 1776, and that occupation ended at the end of the American War of Independence, and since then it's not been occupied. London was one of the European capital cities that was not occupied during World War II, or indeed earlier during the French Revolution and Napoleonic Wars. But Paris, was either under threat from external forces, as in 1792, for example, or 1914, 1918, or occupied by them, as in 1814, 1815, 1870, 71, really, and 1940. And then that's let alone the extent to which there were revolutionary movements, or at least large-scale political instability leading to political crisis, as in the mid-17th century, as in the French Revolutionary crisis, as in the revolutions of 1848 and the Commune in 1871.
What were the origins of the Fronde?
The Fronde is a mid-17th century crisis which focuses on Paris and opposition to the royal government, the opposition to the government of the infant Louis XIII, then wielded by his advisor, Cardinal Mazarin. And it's called the Fronde because of the French for sling, and slings were used by the rioters who took control of the city in protest, this is in 1648, in protest against proposals for new taxation. And it's not until 1652 that Louis XIV makes a ceremonial re-entry of the city at the head of his guards. And again, you know, this underlines this point I was making about the, you know, the instability. Paris had defied and expelled royal forces in 1588. That's Henri III during the French Wars of Religion, he himself being murdered when besieging Paris. In 1610, his successor, Henry IV, Louis XIII's father, was murdered in Paris, and then Louis XIV's government is kicked out in 1648. I mean, it's not surprising that Louis XIV was worried about it, and it's not surprising that alongside the build-up of the Louvre as a fortress, I mean, the problem with the Louvre, as you will know, as Paris will know, is it's very central, and it appears as it is vulnerable, and that encourages people to look outside for their capital.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
What do you mean when you say that, quote, Versailles was of but not in Paris, unquote?
Well, literally, it's not in Paris. It was outside, rather as today we would think of the Charles de Gaulle Airport being outside Paris. But it was of Paris because its location was in that area, because Paris was the principal city and capital of France. And in that sense, Versailles was considerably more central than if the monarch was based in one of the Loire chateaus, for example, at Amboise. As well, the previous nearby location, which would have been the chateau at Vincennes, still impressive, just to the east of central Paris. The problem with that is it was relatively cramped and crowded and was not of the scale that would be sufficient for a royal capital. So Versailles is very much the dominant residence, though Louis XV also hunted at Compiègne. But Louis XVI, for example, spent almost all his time in the Paris area. He went to Reims for his coronation, to Cherbourg to view the harbour works, and to Varennes in 1791 when he was trying to flee the country. But otherwise, Versailles is the key place, and it is a very grand palace by all and any standards, and providing endless opportunities for the display of royal glory. And it also reflects something that we're a bit apt to ignore today, but the cult of the new. If you're going to Versailles, you're seeing something that's new. And it's very interesting that if you look at where people wanted to live who were members of the elite in France, in the Parisian area in the late 17th, early 18th century. They did not want to live in the Marais or the historic core. They wanted to live in the new quarters going up in West Paris or beyond Paris out to near Versailles. And you get the same thing in London. If you want to look at where people are fascinated by in the late 17th, 18th centuries as visitors, they're interested in the new, in the Bank of England, in the Greenwich Observatory. They're not in the new quarter of the West End, which is the equivalent to what's going up in France near the Place de la Concorde. They're not interested in the old and the crowded. Of course, London's a bit different because the old city is largely burnt down in 1666, and there's no comparable fire in Paris, which is one of the classic instances of the importance of things that don't happen and therefore are not written about.
Quite a cute point. Was 18th century Paris a stop on the Grand Tour akin to, say, Rome or Venice?
18th century Paris is very much a stop on the Grand Tour. It's different from Rome and Paris and Venice because those are cities primarily of past splendor. Though in the case of Rome, there is the interest in the Baroque Rome, the Rome of Bernini. But by the second half of the 18th century, it's overwhelmingly an interest in classical antiquity. And Venice is a curiosity. I mean, it's both the city on the water. It's also the sex capital of Europe with its famous courtesans. Paris is the leading city in continental Europe. The French state, very much under Louis XIV, defines sort of modern monarchy. Its reputation is tarnished in the 18th century, and of course, England and London benefits from their political growth. But in terms of aesthetic appeal and supposed cultural elegance, Paris very much attracts tourists, both British tourists and non-British tourists.
How would you compare Paris in the French Revolution with London in the British Civil War?
Well, London in the Civil War is very much the central place of activity. And that is the case until, as it were, the role of London is displaced when Oliver Cromwell seizes power. And in a sense, you could argue the same is true with the French Revolution. Paris is very much the capital of the revolution and the place of prime contention of politics, whether it's the terror or the anti-terror subsequently. But then when Napoleon seizes power in 1799, the capital becomes wherever he is. And he, of course, spends a lot of his time away from Paris, indeed away from France, as commander of the main French field army. And, you know, significant periods of time. I mean, it's no accident that he issues key legislation, for example, the continental system in 1806, the economic, as it were, plan for Europe, is issued from Berlin because he's in Berlin. So I think it's fair to say that Napoleon is less committed to Paris than people might realize. I mean, obviously, he's buried in Paris in the Invalides, and he's responsible for some of the major buildings that go on. And he also, of course, loots most of Western Europe in order to put painting in the in the Louvre. He's responsible for the first stone of the Arc de Triomphe in 1806. And, you know, he's responsible for some of the other buildings of the period, the Châtelet, for example. But he also destroys quite a lot. I mean, in that, what he's doing is continuing the already existing destruction of church buildings, but the temple, for example, which had been a prison since the disbandment of the Knights Templar in 1312, was demolished in 1808, and he goes on destroying quite a lot. Within Paris, he remains mostly in the Tuileries. That's his official residence. And in the Tuileries, he constructs a triumphal arch in 1806. It's still there, of course, as well as a new wing that faces onto a new street, the Rue de Rivoli. And the Rue de Rivoli is named after one of his victories, in fact, against the Austrians in northern Italy. And as you will know, a lot of the place names of Paris, many of them, in fact, used after, applied after he'd fallen from power, and some of them employed by Napoleon III, but many of them reflect or relate to Napoleon I's victories, whether one's thinking of Austerlitz or Wagram, or, you know, you've got Friedland, you've got victories being deployed in that fashion.
Why do you state that contingency rather than structure caused or led to the French Revolution?
Oh, well, I mean, that's the argument I employed in my 18th Century Europe, which remains one of my best books. And I did that by both considering what happened in France, but also by comparing France with other societies which of the period, which also had political strain and economic and social issues. I don't think there's absolutely any inevitability about the fall of Louis XVI or the trajectory of what subsequently happened.
How would you rate overall Baron Haussmann's work?
Well, I think Baron Haussmann, I mean, he's not the only figure reforming municipal provision in that period. You can think of Bazalgette in London, for example. But Haussmann is more politically central. He's préfet of the Seine and director of public works from 1853 to 1870. So that's a long period. And, you know, it's usually argued that the straight boulevards are put in to provide a clearer field of fire, but I think it's fair to say that public order and security was seen as much more than involving rioting crowds. I mean, he's also concerned with microbes. He addresses the city's water and gas supply, the lighting systems, transport flow, builds a municipal morgue. You know, there's a hell of a lot that he does, lays out parks. I think he's responsible for much of the redevelopment of central Paris, but in part that was because Napoleon III gave him the funds and the political power, because Napoleon wanted an exemplary and glorious modernization that would bring prestige to him. What a surprise. I mean, there had been redevelopment in the 1840s, but there was then not the legal mechanisms for large-scale compulsory purchase. And that was something Napoleon III provided. And the new boulevards provided sort of geometry of movement, a sort of a viewpoint. And I think all of that was very significant.
How much anti-German guerrilla activity was there in Paris during the occupation?
Can we just let the clock fire? Right, the question, do you want to repeat it now that the clock's gone?
How much or anti-German guerrilla activity was there in Paris during the occupation?
Well, the principal occupation, of course, is the one during World War II. There is also large-scale German presence in much of France in 1870 to 1871, in which there was popular action against the Germans, which the Germans brutally suppressed by essentially killing people. I think it's fair to say that in 1940, there was some opposition. So Parisian students demonstrated on the 11th of November against the decision to downplay the armistice commemoration, and that demonstration was violently suppressed. But I think it's fair to say that in 40 to 41, that it's relatively quiescent. I mean, there's an assumption that the Germans have won. And also it's worth bearing in mind that this is a period of the communist Nazi pact, that the Soviet Union is very closely aligned with Nazi Germany, something that Vladimir Putin seems to find it convenient to forget, and as a result of which communists were part of, as it were, a alignment which was not that of the resistance. Again, although resistance activity increased from August 41 after the Operation Barbarossa is launched that June, it's more that attacks become more common from early 43. And in my mind, what I think you're looking at there is not just the organization of resistance, but also the sense that the war is turning against the Germans, the combination of, in particular, Stalingrad, but also for that matter, El Alamein, the sense that at some stage there'll be an Anglo-American invasion of France. All of that encourages resistance. I argue in my book that in August 44, when the resistance rises, supported by a lot of the Paris police, incidentally, and there's foot fighting in the boulevards, about 800 to 1,000 members of the resistance are killed. And if you go around central Paris, you'll find bullet holes that have been left as a pointed reminder of the fighting. And you could argue that this shows what could have been done earlier. I mean, you know, in terms of resistance, whether in 1940 to German conquest or subsequently. I think that's true. It's also true that the Germans had punished resistance very harshly. Mass executions, frequent use of torture in order to identify and destroy resistant networks, employing criminals to provide added crony power to the Gestapo, shooting pupils who demonstrated in favor of their arrested teachers, etc., etc. I mean, one does, and let me just underline this point. Some of these people doing this slaughter were members of the Nazi Party. Many of them were not. They were just, you know, parts of the German system. And it's too easily sanitized by referring to these as Nazi crimes. This was German occupation policy, as had been seen, as I emphasized, in 1870 and 71, or for that matter, with the murder by German troops and subsequently by German authorities, of people held to be taking part in opposition, and many of them weren't, in Belgium or occupied France during the First World War.
How has Paris coped with the various changes in the post-1945 period?
Well, that's an interesting question, as it were, assuming that there is a sort of an entity called Paris which decides how to cope. I think there's been very significant economic, social, and political changes. Some of those social changes are highly politically contentious, you know, in the extent to which in the central areas of Paris and it's become very expensive for a lot of Parisians to live, that a lot of the traditional working class areas are increasingly not occupied by the working class, etc., etc. So I think it's fair to say that there has been different ways in which residents have experienced the city, or in fact, in many cases, had to leave it or felt they had to leave it as the Parisian area has been reconceptualized by being expanded outwards. But then you see, that's the last point, is a crucial one, that Paris today is a larger area, an area some of which is pretty unattractive. Sarcelles, which was a relatively new suburb, which was derided in the 1960s as a soulless environment with miserable housing. And obviously there are other area, other issues. You know, if you go to Paris, I was last there a few months ago. You know, there's crime, there's dirty streets, there's homelessness, there's ethnic and racial tensions, there's traffic jams, overcrowded metros, etc., etc., etc. And at the same time, there's a lot that people quite understandably find very attractive about the city. It is the centre of the Francophone world. It's worth bearing in mind that other major cities, you know, London or New York, have many problems. And also, you can live in comfortable suburbs like Soho, as well as in, as it were, less comfortable ones like Malakoff. So partly it's a question of which Paris one means.
How do you envisage Paris's future?
I think that Paris's future is probably going to be relatively benign, because the French state will very much wish to ensure that it is. I think it has a degree of governmental support, which and that includes financial support, as in the support to the Parisian transport system and the support to the Grand Projet you saw under people like, well, under Mitterrand classically. So that, I think, is important. I think there are aspects of the more general problems affecting both France itself, namely, you know, the pensionable age, the increased percentage of the population that don't wish to work or wish to be supported by welfare financed by others. That's a problem, but of course that's a problem across many cultures and societies and many states. So I would have thought that if you are, Paris is always a very, very interesting city to visit. It's actually a very interesting city to stay in. I mean, I first went there in the 60s. I spent a lot of time there in the 80s, working in the Archives étrangères on diplomatic archives, but living in Paris, and that was extraordinarily interesting and pleasant, and it's aesthetically a wonderful city. To live there as permanently as a resident, if you were poor, would not be brilliantly attractive, but then that's true of many places in the world.
If you wanted people to take one thing away from your book, Professor Black, what would it be?
Oh, that it's a fascinating city, and its history is fascinating, and crucially, that if you understand its history, you can understand the city today, because there is so much from the past that is present in modern Paris.
On that observation, which I would like to agree with entirely, I would like to thank you very much, Professor Black, for being so kind as to speak with us today. This is Charles Cotillo. You've been listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel, New Books Network. Thank you, Professor Black, very much.
Thank you. And as I've said, listeners might like to compare and contrast it with my History of London, which is, there's interesting counterpoints, and they might like to decide what they make of the two cities, having read about the two of them. Anyway, thank you.